De-escalation between the U.S. and Iran as President Trump calls for more NATO involvement in the Mideast, a Texas take on what that might mean today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown of the Texas Standard Newsroom. A former ambassador to Iraq and past dean of the Bush School at Texas A&M weighs in on finding a way past military conflict between the U.S. and Iran. Also, a tale of two cities. What, if anything, Austin and Houston might learn from each other when it comes to zoning? And new consumer tech, the hottest of the hot and the nottest of the not. All that and a whole lot more on the National News Show of Texas. And it all gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this ninth day of January 2020. I'm David Brown, coming in today and sitting in traffic, something that is endemic to Texas's big cities in 2020. Three thoughts came to mind. Number one, maybe California really is the future of the U.S. if the de facto parking lot known as rush hour in Texas is any indication. Number two, forget about flying cars. Why hasn't Texas embraced telecommuting more than it has? Which led to number three, the good and the bad that the digital age hath wrought. On the good side, I can get my news instantly. On the not-so-good side, I can get reaction to that news instantly. Although it is probably true that the assassination of an Iranian general with American blood on his hands is no less primitive when committed by drone, it is almost equally true that the popular rush to conclude we are at the brink of World War III is not exactly in the spirit of the Enlightenment. The danger, of course, is that our most popular search terms become a proxy for collective thought, and it's hard to believe this doesn't have political implications for a people fixated on the next military boot to drop. Is diplomacy a write-off in this case? We'll explore a bit later in our broadcast. First up, another byproduct of instant information gratification, the disproportionate number of Texas towns on those viral best cities lists. What can Texas cities do to deal with explosive growth? The addition of 1,000 newcomers per day. What follows is a tale of two cities with two radically different approaches to development. Mike Morris reports on Houston City Hall for the Houston Chronicle. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Audrey McGlinchey is City Hall reporter for our sister station here in the Texas Capital City, KUT 90.5. Audrey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's begin with you, Audrey. City of Austin trying to adopt a new land development code. This would be the first time since what, the 1980s or something?
Yeah, I believe it was 1984, actually, when we last adopted a new land development code.
That's sort of the rub, right? I mean, there has been so much growth since then. What are the main issues surrounding the old code versus what's being proposed?
Right. So one of the big issues that a lot of people talk about with the old code is that we kind of layered a lot of code on top of one another. Mm-hmm. And so when a builder or a landowner goes to make changes or build something new on their land, it becomes really complicated and really expensive to do so. And the more expensive we make it to build in the city, the least likely we are to build. And the things we do build will be more expensive to rent or buy.
Mike, I want to bring you in here because I think a lot of folks are still laboring, certainly nationwide. A lot of folks, Mike, think that Houston is the city without any zoning, right? I mean, that's the myth. It's not so much that you don't have any zoning, but I gather you have never really had a land development code per se there. Is that right?
Well, yeah, we don't have zoning. We don't have a land use, land development code in the same way that zoned cities do. The city cannot restrict land for residential, commercial, industrial, that sort of thing. And, you know, it's important to note that most of the growth and the recent boom and almost all of the growth in recent years has been outside the city limits anyway, in what people view as Houston, but is really unincorporated Harris County, where, to my knowledge, counties aren't even able to adopt zoning in the first place.
All right. So what exactly are the issues there in Houston? Does it, what Audrey was describing, did any of that sound familiar to you?
Sure. I think that developers here would probably view those complaints as familiar. Houston does have, Houston and Harris County have rules on developing, and they are often layered. If you're building a single-family development, you have to look at a code that governs density, and you have to look at a code that governs green space. And, you know, if you're building a commercial business. There are parking codes and all sorts of other things that are overlapping. There's not really a push to change anything all at once because, you know, I think it's five times since the Second World War that voters have rejected zoning here. People seem to have made their peace with our free-for-all.
So what does that mean when it comes to what happens next for Houston? I mean, is there a completely different approach, or is the city looking at trying to rein things in?
In the 10 years I've covered local government in this region, I've never heard of a credible push to try again on a zoning referendum. What I don't think Houstonians or Houston public officials have really grappled with is that in the past, this free-for-all in some ways led development to create more affordable housing in some areas because costs were lower and there were fewer restrictions and people weren't all restricted to build certain types of housing in desirable areas. But our affordability is going away. And I don't think city leaders would claim to have gotten their arms around that.
Well, you know, Audrey, the city of Austin is nowhere nearly as dense as Houston.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that Austin city leaders think that they can come up with a plan that will, you know, make things better here? Do we really need greater density in a city that doesn't have an infrastructure to support it?
I think the issue and a lot of the issues that people have taken with the current code or the current way that we build is that we've restricted ourselves to really only building either single family homes. That's one home on a piece of land where one family can live, or big apartment buildings. People have probably seen a lot of those going up in the past couple of years. And so a lot of people have argued there's a way that we can add maybe less intensive density, things like townhomes or duplexes, which is really hard to build under the new code. And by that, we can allow all the people that are moving here to find a place to live and not, you know, jack up prices, while also hopefully kind of maintaining the look of Austin that many people have said they enjoy, the look of certain neighborhoods, for example.
Well, who does this accommodate, though? Does it accommodate people who are already in Austin, or does it accommodate people who might be coming to Austin? Furthermore, what you were saying about how you have sort of a mishmash, a checkerboard of different rules and regulations. It seems like this is streamlining things for developers, but what about for people who have made an investment in their property, who have bought into a community? I was looking at the zoning map, and it seems like if you've got a lot of money, you're not going to have your property and your zoning tweaked all that much.
Well, you know, a lot of people have asked, well, aren't we just accommodating the people that are moving here? Sure. But we also can't stop people from moving to Austin. There's really no way the city can do that. And other people have argued that we're also accommodating the people who are already here. If there is some evidence that if we allow for more housing to be built, it's a supply and demand argument, that we could potentially lower or at the very least stabilize prices here. And then there's also the question as people age, as their family status changes, that people desire different types of houses that they want to live in. You know, if you're raising a couple of kids and then those kids go off and living their own lives, perhaps you want something smaller. And so should we build different types of housing for different phases of people's lives? And right now we don't really have that. So, yeah, I think it's a big question of, again, who are we doing this for? But what's happening right now is not great. Prices are going up exponentially. And so people say we can't keep doing what we're doing. We have to do something different. And this is what they've come up with.
I understand that the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas has said that Houston's gentrifying faster than other Texas cities. We looking at greater affordability and gentrification concerns there as a result of the approach that Houston has taken, do you think, Mike?
I don't know how much to attribute to the approach that has been taken. I think there's sort of this conventional wisdom that the laissez-faire approach has held prices down for longer.
Mm-hmm.
Setting aside whether that's true or not, I think you get enough growth, as we've seen, in the region and in the city, and prices are inevitably going to rise. And, you know, we've seen that pressure over time, kind of just a slow march. Fourth Ward, just west of downtown, Freedman's Town, a historic area founded by freed slaves. Those areas are essentially erased. And sort of next on the list our second ward, third ward, fifth ward, all of these areas near downtown are under increasing gentrification pressure. I mean, we're also seeing some data that the old adage of drive until you qualify, that means, you know, you have X income, you can afford X amount in a mortgage.
Yeah.
If you can't get it close to downtown, drive half an hour away, 45 minutes away, an hour away until you can qualify and get into a house that you want. That is not, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of people trumpeting the wisdom of that sort of development strategy.
Oh, I wonder if there's a consensus that the status quo is insufficient. I mean, for instance, what I hear from you just then, Mike, is that people are still doing the same old thing. I mean, they're going out, they're driving further. And as you understand it, people don't believe that they've reached that sort of maximum limit yet. And Houston continues to grow.
Well, I think it's two things. I mean, I think that developers will continue to build a product that sells, and the suburbs are continuing to sell. I think we see that in the numbers. I think that closer into the urban core, there are a lot of families, there are a lot of politicians who are not satisfied with the status quo and want more affordable options closer in.
Growing pains, I suppose, the way we should file this one. That's Mike Morris, City Hall reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Also, Audrey McGlinchey, City Hall reporter with our home station, KUT 90.5. Audrey, Mike, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Thursday. What you seeing out there, Wills Dunbar?
Hi, David. Well, our friends and listeners are tuned into this fascinating talk about urban growth issues affecting cities across the state. Here are some of the things they've noted themselves. Brad Emmons on our Facebook page says that in his city, Austin, any city-sponsored free event that's family-friendly has become overwhelmed by crowds. He offers that maybe the city could sponsor similar events farther from Central to spread things out, but moreover, recreation and green spaces have grown noticeably more crowded throughout the year. John Michael Tullis says that a lot of growth is taking place on the edges of cities along small rural roads that can't handle the population increase and that aren't getting updated nearly quickly enough. He says many that he's experienced are riddled with potholes and ruts. And also echoing some of what we just heard, Eric Ballantyne says he is concerned about climate change and how it is going to remake cities moving forward. Just some of the comments on our Facebook page. I see some coming in via Twitter as well. Yep. Just some of the conversation we're seeing out there on social media. I'll be back with more later in the broadcast.
You know, it's really hard to square wanting to increase density when you have an infrastructure that can barely support what's already here. But a point made that you can't stop people from coming. So what do you think, Texas? Tweet us. Join the conversation on Facebook. Just look for Texas Standard no matter where you are. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Howdy, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The Department of Veterans Affairs is experimenting with ways to keep older veterans out of nursing homes and assisted living facilities. As Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project, one pilot program in Texas places federally backed volunteers in the homes of veterans who could use a bit of help around the house.
92-year-old World War II veteran Jerry Bennett lives by himself in an apartment community mostly made up of seniors.
I like the independence of having my own place and doing my own thing and so on.
He's considered moving to an assisted living facility, but doesn't think it would be a good fit, at least not yet.
I think I don't like it, as you are conformed to things that they do, and I don't feel I need the kind of help that people in a lot of people in assisted living need.
Bennett still drives. He works out at Gold's Gym, goes to the senior center, and sometimes drops by a nearby VFW post. But sometimes feelings of isolation creep in. His wife died 7 years ago, and his children are scattered across the country.
I have nobody down here, no relations. If it gets a little lonely, if I feel like I'm getting depressed, I'll give Gloria a call. We'll talk.
Bennett's talking about 70-year-old Gloria Estrello, his neighbor and a volunteer with a new VA pilot program. She cooks, cleans, and exercises with Bennett and keeps in touch with his children about his health. She's also his rival in seven-card rummy.
What do you want to play today?
Seven? Are you guys pretty competitive with your cards?
Of course.
Estrello and Bennett are part of a 5-city pilot called the Choose Home Senior Corps program. It was created by the VA and the Corporation for National and Community Service, a federally funded agency that also administers the AmeriCorps program. It recruits volunteers over 55 to help out in veterans' houses. Some of the vets already rely on primary caregivers. Others just need a little bit of help and companionship. Kelly Gallant coordinates the program in San Antonio.
There's been many, many, many studies on, you know, how when you're isolated like that, there can be a lot of chronic things that can come up as far as with your health.
The program is part of a broader VA effort to keep veterans out of institutional care. Scotty Hartruff is with the VA's Office of Geriatrics and Extended Care. He says initiatives like Choose Home cut cost and try to honor veterans' wishes.
As technology improves and medical care improves and people live longer, how can we really honor their preferences to remain in the home as long as it's safe to do so?
The veteran population, like the rest of America, faces a long-term care bubble. The VA's annual costs of nursing home care have risen to almost $6 billion. By 2024, that number could top $10 billion, a huge chunk of the department's budget. VA Undersecretary Teresa Boyd told Congress in February that as veterans age, approximately 80% will develop the need for long-term services and support.
There's an urgent need to accelerate the increase in the availability of the services since most veterans prefer to receive care at home. And VA can improve quality at a lower cost by providing care in these settings.
Still, keeping veterans at home longer can put a burden on family caregivers, usually wives, children, or younger siblings. Gallant, the program coordinator in Texas, says she's seen situations where they just can't do it all. In those cases, volunteers may mean the difference between a veteran being institutionalized or not.
Sometimes the caregiver will get burned out, and prematurely they'll have to put them in a nursing home, and they don't want to have to do that.
In addition to San Antonio, the Choose Home Senior Corps program is also underway in Colorado Springs, Las Vegas, Pittsburgh, and Glendive, Montana. Gallant hopes the pilot will expand. She says in her city, the demand for volunteers is outpacing supply. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Carson's story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration reporting on American military life and veterans, with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Every year around this time, the Consumer Electronics Show sprawls across Las Vegas, bringing with it hints of what's next in technology, both the exciting and the not so much. Some of what's on display will never make it to market, but a lot of it will eventually find its way into your living room or your pocket or purse. Watch out. Intrepid CES watcher Omar Gallaga is back to share a few highlights from the big show. Welcome back to Texas, Omar. You got out there, right? Did you head out to Vegas?
No, I did not make it out to CES.
Oh, well, you know, that's you've been there before, I know. I
mean, it's a huge kind of eye-boggling trade show. I find that actually covering it from afar is a little bit, more ground.
You're not the first person who's told me this. So what are the big themes at CES this year?
A lot of it this year is sort of the rollout of 5G, which we've been talking a lot about on this show, just sort of the devices and the networks that are going to kind of emerge from that. Mm-hmm. Robots are a running theme, robots and automation and things that are meant to make your life easier via app or what have you. And then artificial intelligence. I mean, that is the big buzzword this year. AI is in everything. And I'm a little bit skeptical that any of these devices are smarter than the ones we had last year. Mm-hmm. But AI is going to be kind of getting consumerized. They're kind of using that as a word for a lot of consumer tech products that didn't have it before.
Sort of a buzz phrase, I guess. Do we really need smart washing machines, though?
That's the question. Is this stuff any better than what we're already using? I'm seeing a lot of devices that are throwing AI in, and it doesn't really mean anything. You know, they're not any smarter. It's just sort of a word being used to make you think that it's going to learn from your habits and work better. I mean, I have a lot of smart devices that have AI that get dumber the more I use them, it feels like.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm not going to mention any names, but yes, I'm thinking of one device in particular that seems to get dumber and dumber as we use it.
Yeah,
but
it understands me less the more I talk to it. Yeah. Yes,
Might know what I'm referring to. TV vendors starting to show off their 8K TVs, right? I'm wondering when these will be ready for us to buy and whether they're going to make much of a difference compared to those 4K sets that some of us may have already.
Yeah, if you think back to, like, I guess it maybe was about 10 years ago when we first started hearing about 4K TVs, mm-hmm. it's going to be a while. I mean, the TVs are out there. You can buy an 8K TV right now,
yeah.
But you're going to spend, you know, upwards of $10,000, and there's no programming for it yet. There's no devices that can actually put out the 8K to enjoy
it
that.
Seems so a little kind of pointless, like early, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like the early stages of 4K where people were buying these sets and then there was nothing to watch on them that was 4K. It's going to be a while. And the advice you're going to get from a lot of tech experts is just don't buy them right now. They're going to start rolling out there, but it's going to be a couple of years before it's actually worth getting one of those.
I think that's really good advice. I saw the other day a photograph that had been taken several years back of one of the early 4K sets, $20,000 price tag, $20,000, you know.
And now they're what, $200, $300?
Exactly, yeah, something crazy.
You're going to want to wait on that.
Apparently, there's a belief out there that we and our furry friends don't have enough technology in our bathrooms. Now, I've heard that the Japanese are big on this. How's this playing out at CES?
Well, like, you know, bidets and Japanese toilets are always a hot item at CES. But this year, the one that's getting a lot of attention and mockery is an AI-powered litter box, automated scooping and analyzing.
Actually, I'm going to say that's a great idea. I'm just going to throw that out there. And
$400,
say
maybe?
Well, yeah. I don't know about that, but I like the idea of somebody else having to deal with a litter box, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, this might be going a few steps beyond that because it's a $400 litter box from a company called iCuddle that actually analyzes the droppings and kind of can determine, like, should you be feeding your cat more water, less,
no.
And it connects with an automatic feeder and water dispenser. So it's sort of a whole ecosystem of cat products. If you never want to have any contact with your cat at all, why not?
My cat didn't want to have any contact with me, so there we, but no, I mean, there have been sort of automated devices, and I guess that's really the question here. What separates AI from the old automated devices that, say, Sharper Image and those companies used to offer in the past?
I don't think that there really is. I feel like it's being used more as a marketing term for devices that were already doing these kinds of things for many years. So I think it's more like, hey, it's got AI.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole lot more new stuff that Omar Gayaga covers from right here in the Lone Star State, by the way. You should check him out online. Omar Gayaga, thanks so much for taking a couple of minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. Good to chat.
Thank you, humans and cats, for listening.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Most Texans in the U.S. House are expected to vote along party lines today on a measure that would force President Trump to limit military actions against Iran unless authorized by Congress. North Texas Republican Michael Burgess told Fox News Channel this morning he believes the non-binding War Powers Resolution is unnecessary.
This isn't even a real authorization because what it says when you read the context of the joint resolution, it's that the president may not continue the war in Iran. There is no war in Iran right now, right?
Congressman Burgess argued the president has already de-escalated the situation. Many House Democrats from Texas have criticized Trump for killing an Iranian general without consulting Congress and are calling for limiting his powers to wage war with the country. The House is expected to vote on the resolution later today. Texas is airdropping packets of rabies vaccine across the state. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports it's part of an annual effort to combat the deadly disease.
Over the next 2 weeks, about 1 million doses of rabies vaccines will be distributed in 19 counties along the Texas border, particularly in rural areas. The Texas Department of State Health Services has been doing its oral rabies vaccination program for 26 years. In the mid-1990s, the program was developed in response to major outbreaks in South and West Texas. Officials say the goal is to make sure those strains aren't reintroduced in animals migrating to the state. So they're airdropping small edible packets covered in fish meal crumbles that contain the vaccine in hopes wildlife will likely eat them. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
The Dallas County District Attorney says his office will challenge nearly all gag orders that judges issue. John Cruzo's announcement Wednesday comes after a contempt charge against him was dropped. Attorneys for former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger accused Cruzo of violating a gag order over a television interview he gave before the start of her murder trial in September. At a news conference yesterday, Cruzo said he thought the interview with KDFW-TV was supposed to be about mental health.
I trusted that that's what the story would be about. I know I don't have any control over what reporters do and what they report, but I just want to let you all know and let the public know that at no time did anybody in this office try to derail that trial, try to influence that trial.
That audio is courtesy of the Dallas Morning News. Geiger is currently serving a 10-year sentence for fatally shooting her neighbor, Botham Jean, in 2018. And the amount of Texas experiencing drought grew slightly this week to nearly 38%, according to new figures the U.S. Drought Monitor released this morning. Governor Greg Abbott last week declared a state of disaster for 17 Texas counties dealing with prolonged drought. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. 'Tis the season when your inbox starts filling with W-2s, 1095-Cs, maybe a 1099 MISC or two for you entrepreneurial sorts. Tax season, in other words. Doing your taxes is, well, at best a chore, at worst perhaps a source of dread. For looming over those hours of data entry is the specter of the audit. The IRS asking to crack open your books to make sure everything's on the up and up. The threat of the audit isn't quite what it used to be, however, according to new data from the IRS. Here to tell us more, Richard Rubin. He's tax reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the Texas Standard, Richard.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I mean, each year, lots of folks get a letter from the IRS asking a question about past returns. What exactly constitutes an audit?
An audit is what they call an examination. It's a more thorough look at a particular issue where they flagged a problem. It's something sort of beyond you added some numbers wrong, or beyond you said what you owe but you haven't paid it. That's a more of a collections issue. It can be in person or by mail, but where you've got an IRS examiner assigned to you looking at, did you do everything correctly? Did you report all your income? That kind of thing.
So what is the IRS saying about the rate of individual audits?
It has now declined for the eighth straight year. So now 0.45% of individual tax returns, that's less than half of 1%,
were
audited for 2019. That's less than half of what the rate was about 10 years ago. And it's certainly far below what it was in the 80s and 90s. And that's really a function of the fact that the IRS's budget has been cut. It's a smaller agency than it used to be, and so it just doesn't have the resources to go after as many people as it once did.
See, I wondered about that, because on the one hand, you could say, well, okay, they have less money to engage in enforcement. On the other hand, there's a sort of a philosophy that certain administrations have taken when it comes to the IRS, and the Trump administration, the IRS is not exactly, they're not best friends, shall we say.
It's actually interesting. It's true, and if you think about the president's tax returns, he's complained about the IRS for sure, but the Treasury Secretary has talked about trying to add more money to the IRS and beefing up enforcement. This is not a philosophical decision by the Trump administration itself necessarily to weaken enforcement. It is more the result of years, mostly of Republican efforts in Congress to keep the IRS's budget shrinking. The IRS budget, to put it in perspective, if you adjust for inflation, you know, it peaked in 2010 and it's now 20% below that. And we obviously have a larger population than we did back then. The flip side of that, of course, is that at some level, the IRS can be getting more efficient, right? Just like your business and my business are more efficient right. because of technology than they used to be.
Right.
So at some point, there are limits to how efficient the IRS can be with additional technology. You know, in any kind of law enforcement, it's not just enforcing it and getting money that results. It's sort of that knowledge that there's a cop on the beat. And so that combination of things the IRS is looking at, but they just don't have as many bodies as they used to.
Is there any way of knowing just how much revenue the federal government's losing through lax enforcement, or maybe through an inability to enforce more thoroughly?
Well, let's put it a couple ways. One is the IRS says there's hundreds of billions of dollars a year that go uncollected. Some of that is because people know that they owe and just don't have the money to pay. There are some academic estimates that say that if more aggressive enforcement could generate $1 trillion over a decade, so that's $100 billion a year, that's on a $3-4 trillion out of federal revenue.
Wow.
So it's, you know, it's not nothing, but it's not like a giant increase, but there's money there. And there's pretty clear consensus that every additional dollar spent on enforcement, at least in the short run, can yield another $4 at least in revenue. So there's absolutely money being left on the table right now by underfunding and underenforcing the tax code.
So what sort of reaction have you been getting from regular folks, readers, that sort of thing, to this news you've been reporting?
I mean, it's mixed. Look, no one likes being audited. It's no fun. So obviously there's some level of response that, yeah, well, that's fine, right? They used to be too aggressive, and if they're defanged a little bit, that's okay. And then, you know, there's a lot of, in the policy community, a fair amount of concern about what this might do. And the real fear out there is that voluntary compliance starts shrinking.
In fact, I sort of wonder whether it's good policy for the IRS to release these figures. If it shows that there are fewer audits, I don't know how many taxpayers are going to say, well, you know, have you heard the news?
Sure. They do the opposite of this too, which is to talk a lot about how aggressive they're being. They, as we get closer to tax time, they will start, so, you know, announcing prosecutions of people, sometimes famous people. They are careful to note that, yes, these audit numbers are down, but they absolutely say the IRS is out there in every neighborhood and getting more sophisticated with how it goes after people for not paying their taxes. And so I'm certainly not going to advise you to not file a return or not pay your taxes, you know.
Richard Rubin covers tax policy with the Wall Street Journal. We'll have a link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Richard, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on The Standard.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Bob Daddio Wade, the 76-year-old artist whose work inspired the documentary Too High, Too Long, and Too Wide, died of heart failure on Christmas Eve. We featured Wade back in 2017 for our project called From Heel to Toe, Stories About Texans and Their Boots. Do you remember?
Hi, I'm Bob Wade. I live here in Austin, Texas, and I'm a full-time artist and do crazy giant outdoor projects from time to time, including the world's biggest cowboy boots in San Antonio, Texas. I had done a big sculpture in upstate New York, which ended up on the roof of the Lone Star Cafe, the giant iguana. A lot of the Austin bands, Jerry Jeff Walker, Sleep of the Wheel, I mean, everybody you can think of from Austin, Doug Somm, everybody played the Lone Star Cafe at one time or another. Basically, what happened was the iguana got put on the roof of the Lone Star in 1978 and stayed there until 1989 when the place closed. But in early 79, I got a call from a guy who had seen the iguana, and he was the director of a place in Washington, D.C. called the Washington Project for the Arts. He said, I saw your iguana, said, we're doing a brand new outdoor public art project in D.C., 3 blocks from the White House. Come on down to D.C. and let's talk about you doing something big on a corner. So I went down there and took photos and thought about it and discussed it. Went back to Dallas is where I was living. And thinking about this whole idea of Texas politicians, Sam Rayburn and all those guys that came up from Texas to be senators or whatever, especially LBJ, who was always wearing his boots and his little LBJ hat and all that kind of stuff. So I said, you know, maybe a giant pair of boots would be perfect. And the way this lot was configured, it had this tall building on right next to one side and another building. So it was like a niche. And the best thing that can go in that niche, that would fill it horizontally and vertically and hold the scale, would be a giant pair of cowboy boots. So I designed them to be 40 feet high and 30 feet long. It was a very lucky thing happened. So I got a call and said, Mr. Wade, we understand your booths might be for sale. We're the Rouse Company. We'd like to send them to Texas. And I went, oh my gosh, what a luck out. So three trucks pulled up. So we started loading these components on. And very shortly after that, we wrote a song called Too High, Too Wide, Too Long. Because they were too wide. I mean, they were hung over the sides. They were too high. Hit an overpass when they were leaving the town. So these guys took back roads all the way to San Antonio so they wouldn't get stopped by the cops. So they were actually taken to San Antonio in late 79 and were unveiled in early 1980, and they've been there ever since.
Bob Daddy O. Wade passed away on Christmas Eve, but his art lives on, as does the story of his boots. Got a story of your own to share? Email us, texasstandard@kut.org, and one of our producers will get back at you. Aha. From Swiss Avenue to the West End, Dallas has many dutifully preserved historic districts. That status is meant to protect the look and feel of some of the city's oldest neighborhoods. Hasn't been the case along 10th Street, however, an historically black neighborhood just south of downtown where many homes have been neglected, even torn down. In the first of a two-part story, KERA's Miguel Perez looks into the rise and fall of a once thriving community.
Sean Montgomery is waiting for me outside of the N.W. Harley Early Childhood Center. It's the crown jewel of her neighborhood. She points to a historic marker planted on the front lawn.
10th Street Historic District, Freedmanstown.
Montgomery says at least seven generations of her family have lived here.
An important African-American enclave within the historically white community of Oak Cliff.
But the history of 10th Street is fading. Empty lots dot the streets on this pie-shaped piece of land just south of downtown Dallas. Many homes are abandoned, boarded up, and smeared in spray paint. It wasn't always this way.
They were maintained, and they had beautiful lawns. You don't see it now. We loved it. We loved being in the neighborhood.
That dirty Trinity River.
This part of Dallas was settled by freed slaves after the Civil War. By the 1900s, 10th Street had become a vibrant community. The neighborhood, bound by segregation, had no choice but to sustain itself. So black doctors, lawyers, and teachers set up offices directly in their homes.
This house belonged to Dr. Nathaniel Watts. A lot of the doctors, African American, were not able to practice in the hospitals.
By the 50s, 10th Street was feeling the strain of growth happening across the city. Dallas was bursting at the seams.
As business grows, population grows, and the snowball keeps rolling until there appears to be no limit to the area's potential.
But there is a limit, and it's already pinching. The problem of traffic. A problem of Dallas progress.
That's from a film produced by the Dallas Citizens Traffic Commission in 1955, the same year Interstate 35 bulldozed through 10th Street. Dozens of homes were torn down to make way for construction. Longtime resident Patricia Cox says the neighborhood has never healed.
The freeway came right between and cut us off. Instead of rebuilding, they just tore it down.
Wealthy black families started to move away in the 60s, and local businesses died out. 10th Street earned its historic designation in 1993, but residents say little has been done to help them preserve their homes. They point to a 2010 ordinance passed by the Dallas City Council that gave the city permission to demolish structures in historic districts that are smaller than 3,000 square feet. Residents like Montgomery say that rule has unfairly targeted the more modest homes in her community compared to the loftier homes in other districts where wealthier, typically white residents live.
It's hurtful that an area that's been around since the 1800s, you're not putting in the same type of care and money. But well, I guess we can't go back to yesterday. We can only just push forward, you know, for the future.
And a brighter future might be on the horizon. In August, the Dallas City Council, led by Councilwoman Carolyn King Arnold, voted to stop city-funded demolitions in 10th Street, nearly a decade after the ordinance was passed. 10th Street is part of Arnold's district.
They have been waiting for the city to fulfill the basic obligations of providing basic infrastructure. And so this is just the first step in fighting for a community that I know, and they don't want to be displaced or gentrified.
community leaders like Patricia Cox are hopeful that residents will not only keep their community, but improve it too.
I see nice homes, beautiful gardens. I see businesses. I think it would be like a star.
It's been a long time since 10th Street has shined, but residents say that someday it's going to shine again. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess you could say that 10th Street shines on in the music of T-Bone Walker, right? He grew up along 10th Street. Neighborhood now an endangered historic district we've been hearing about. T-Bone Walker was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame back in 1987. Story goes that B.B. King once said that it was T-Bone Walker that made him want to play the blues. So, rather influential indeed.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
This is the Texas Standard. So, de-escalation between the U.S. and Iran, is it for real? Assuming that we are further from World War III than previously feared, what are the next steps for that other tool of foreign policy, diplomacy? Ryan Crocker is former ambassador to Iraq and former dean of Texas A&M University's George Bush School of Government and Public Service. Ambassador, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
At last word, this has been described by the president as a, well, let me put it this way. He is saying that Iran has appears to be backing down. And the general consensus, at least among those who have been analyzing this on cable television and the like, appears to be a de-escalation is what we are witnessing. How would you characterize what's going on?
I would caution about getting too caught up in the moment. I think this is a pause. The Iranians dropped some missiles on bases where our troops were present without hurting anyone. They did it via apparently ballistic missiles fired from Iran. The foreign minister's statement right after the firing was interpreted, I think, correctly as saying, okay, we've made the point here. And then, of course, the president, when he spoke, also, I think, worked to de-escalate. But it's a pause. This war didn't start the day before yesterday, and it's not going to end the day after tomorrow. So it is not time for the victory lap. I think we have put ourselves at a new level in this conflict with Iran. It's been going on almost since the 1979 revolution with the killing of Qasem Soleimani. So I think there is a lot more to play here.
The president yesterday said that he wants NATO to be more engaged in the Middle East. And that's a dimension of this crisis that hasn't really been elaborated much, at least in the U.S. media. What about our other allies in the region, in particular, you know, Israel? But I also want to talk about NATO as well, which has had a presence there.
This is an important point. The strengths of America since World War II has, at least in part, rested on our many, many alliances. We have them, our competitors don't, China and Russia. Arguably, the most consequential of those alliances is NATO. And NATO's had a rough time under the Trump presidency, as we've all seen. They have been with us in Afghanistan from the beginning and with us in Iraq, largely in a training capacity. We need to pay attention to NATO. I don't know what the president meant with that reference in the statement, but anything that shows this administration engaging with NATO instead of merely criticizing it, I think is good for us. So we'll see here.
I want to ask about one aspect of this. You served at the height of the sectarianism and its aftermath, and I wonder whether or not Iran has, in firing these ballistic missiles and making it appear as though there's a de-escalation, if in a way it has ultimately set itself up to get what it wants without having to do much further fighting. I mean, if the U.S. were to leave Iraq, Iran, it seems, may have virtually a green light to be further involved in shaping the future of Iraq, right? Mission accomplished.
Well, that has been the problem, actually, since we withdrew all of our forces in 2011. As you recall, among others, Islamic State took advantage of our absence to surge into Iraq in 2014, which, again, led to us returning troops to Iraq where they are now. So this all rests on what Iran sees as its national security interests here. It is a very opaque society, to say the very least, and I won't pretend that I know what they think. But one could argue they have to take into account that if we are gone completely, we may get Islamic State back. So this is multidimensional chess that everybody is playing here. Everyone, Iran, the U.S., Iraq, the Europeans, other Middle Eastern countries are going to have to calculate moves very, very carefully. And I hope the administration is fully aware of this. And again, understanding this conflict is not over. It's at a pause moment. Where it goes from here will depend on what others do and say and what we do and say.
Ryan Crocker is former ambassador to Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Kuwait, and Lebanon. He is former dean of Texas A&M University's George Bush School of Government and Public Service and current diplomat in residence at Princeton. Ambassador Crocker, thanks so much for taking a few moments out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Let's check in with Wells Dunbar. He's our social media editor. We'll find out what folks are talking about across the Lone Star State. I see you have some tweets in your hand right there.
I certainly do. I have some dispatches from social media. Mm-hmm. I have to say, a lot of people chiming in about a story we heard earlier in the program, that decade-low rate of audits from the IRS that you were discussing with that reporter from the Wall Street Journal seems to have struck a nerve with several people on our Facebook page. There, Kim Nahara says it's another example of how the rich are taxed less than the middle class in terms of how much they pay. Morgan Hamilton says, what do you expect when there just aren't enough auditors? And meanwhile, Dallas Hall says, gee, with Trump in office, who is surprised? However, Jordan Patterson says, good, and calls the IRS the closest thing we have to a Gestapo here in the States. Meanwhile, Luis Fernando Reyes Diaz, he says that his 24 dependents and I are so pleased to hear this news. I think a little bit of a joke there.
Yeah, I think
24
maybe
dependents, it's a whole
right,
bunch.
Right, yeah, I get it.
So, but yeah, an interesting byproduct of what we've seen with, I guess, Republican dislike of the IRS, you could say, and this sort of dwindling budget that they've been subject to over years and years and years. Well, you know, maybe we should shift from our 1040s to our 409ks and see how they're doing. Yeah, have you seen this?
I have heard we reached. Did we touch 29,000?
Did we?
I know that we were fast approaching it, man.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to check
and
find out.
Yeah, let's pull that up.
Yeah,
well, you know, maybe that's obviously the reason that President Trump was tweeting about this. He believed the words from the president earlier today. How are your 409Ks doing? About 8 digits off from the popular workplace investment vehicle, the 401K.
Yeah.
So obviously coming in for a lot of, dribbing and whatnot there on Twitter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Drabbing. Dipping. People saying their 409Ks were full of coffee and hamburger futures and things of that ilk.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
a lot of yucking it up there online.
Sure.
Another a fun day on Twitter compared to all the sort of, edge of your seat nervousness that has characterized use of social media as of late. Yeah, what's the market doing there, David?
Pretty interesting stuff. 29,000 level in sight for the Dow. MarketWatch is reporting that investors are putting Mideast worries onto the back burner. That 29,000 mark doesn't mean a whole lot.
Yeah.
It's more of a psychological benchmark, but if it did hit 29,000, that would be a first.
On to 30 and beyond, baby.
You know, what happens?
409Ks just plunging into the
409Ks. The funny thing is, I mean, once you reach these psychological barriers, sometimes you end up with a dramatic pullback as people sort of freak out a little bit about how high things are going. What do you make of all this news, Texas? Tweet us and let us know. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. You don't have to use Twitter. That's the end of the big broadcast for today. Of course, news continues over at TexasStandard.com, and we hope you'll join us right here tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare.
The Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.